a drone that follows you everywhere, geeky cooking gadgets, and recovering data on a Mac. Live from the Twit Studios in Petaluma, it's the new Screensavers.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This episode of the new Screensavers is brought to you by CashFly. Make this the last month your CDN bill gives you a headache. Join the thousands of others who trust CashFly's reliable network. For a complimentary, detailed analysis of your current CDN bill and usage trends, visit twit.cashfly.com. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/NSS. Welcome to the new Screensavers. This is episode 173 for Saturday, September 8th, 2018. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Alex Lindsay.
Leo is not here.
We've taken over.
Yes, we have.
Leo's on vacation.
Yes. He's been on vacation, and it's quite quiet around here.
It has been. I came in. Usually there's this hurricane of things happening. I got here, and it was just, you know, a little quieter.
And I won't name you, but someone in the chat room said, no offense to Alex and Megan, but without Leo there, I'm surprised anyone's here at all. No offense.
I don't think that's bad at all. It's okay.
Today we have a lot of exciting things. Jason Howell went and found a self-driving camera.
Nice.
A drone, he took it for a test drive, mm-hmm. So that is exciting. We're going to see that.
I'm also going to show you some of my geeky cooking things that make my life easier. Hopefully they make your life a little bit easier. And we're also going to talk about data recovery on the Mac OS and more of your questions for call for help.
But first, we're going to get to the hottest hot topic. There were congressional hearings this week, Facebook. Jack Dorsey from Twitter was there with his beard, empty chair.
he almost forgot his beard, and then he was like, oh, fortunately, it stuck to my head.
That was one of my favorite parts. Like, one congressperson said, you don't look like the CEO of a big company like Twitter with your beard. Like, millennium shaming.
He should have shown up with like a t-shirt and showed all his tats, and yeah, that would have been like,
yeah, well, he also has a nose ring too, so
right, there you go.
He was showing that off. But then that happened, and then on Thursday Twitter finally, beard or no, they banned Alex Jones.
And it sounds like part of that was from the fact that Alex Jones showed up when Jack Dorsey was and caused more trouble. And essentially, Alex Jones is a provocateur, and he doesn't know how to do anything other than provoke. Mm-hmm. And he finally provoked too much.
Yeah.
So he's been kicked off not only Twitter, but also the App Store. Everyone's just finally, he's just that kid that finally everybody said, yeah, we don't want to play with you anymore. He had a couple friends left, and then they were like, even for us, you're too much.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, this has been brewing for so long, and, you know, everyone was waiting for someone to jump, you know, and then...
Well, and the hard part is that this is not a freedom of speech issue, by the way. This is not a First Amendment... Well, it's a freedom of speech issue, but not a First Amendment issue, because mm-hmm. the First Amendment is only related to the government telling you can't talk, not companies can tell you not to talk anytime they want. Mm-hmm. But I think the problem is people don't want to get into that. Like, getting into that morass of deciding what goes in and what goes out not only is very complicated, but it's also puts them at risk of becoming publishers. Mm-hmm. You know, and once they become publishers, then they're under an entirely different set of regulation, which is what they're trying to step around. He just made it so apparent that this was getting out of control that they decided not to have him anymore.
Yeah, I mean, there is some...
The rice is ready.
Oh.
That's one of the geeky gadgets, the thing that you hear off in the distance. It's singing me a song that says, hey, your rice is ready.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that the biggest thing here for me is there's there's got to be a line drawn somewhere.
Right.
And who are the people drawing that line, and why are they drawing it?
Right.
That is the big question that I have in all of this stuff.
And I think that the challenge that we always have, and I think that one of the reasons that the First Amendment exists, was because when people want to be, if they're not heard, if they want to say things and they're not heard, they'll keep yelling louder and louder and louder, and then it gets violent. Mm-hmm. You know, what we see in the Middle East is a lot of people that don't get heard. So, mm-hmm. And they get very upset, and then they do something else. And so we want to be careful of wanting, you know, sometimes you just want to let people to blow off their steam. You know, and I think that a lot of people get afraid of people's words. And I grew up in the country, so I, you know, we always had a crazy Uncle Joe that just said crazy things. And you're like, you know, like, and so in the country, people just go, oh, just ignore Joe. You know, Joe's crazy. But people in the city go, oh, Joe's crazy.
Yeah.
Scary. So people in the country, and Alex Jones is just kind of like, just ignore him. He's crazy.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, because I grew up in Texas, so there were lots of crazy uncles and all that kind of thing. And
But you just learned to kind of filter them out.
Well, and people said what they felt.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And then when I went to college in Baltimore, that was what was, people were hiding what they, you know, so you'd make friends with someone and, you know, think they believe similar things, and all of a sudden they turn out to be this horrible racist. And you're like, well, why didn't you just show me that to begin with?
Exactly.
Like the people in Texas did that were racist. Not everyone in Texas is racist. But, you know, it's like hiding, and you don't know. And we talked to Jeff Jarvis this week and he's, you know, host of This Week in Google and journalism professor. And he had some great thoughts about this. And he had no solution to the problem.
Right.
But just basically, like, we have to accept that the internet is speech. It's not media. It's not, you know, it is speech, and that it's... We have to figure out, we have to let people talk. And without all this free speech, we wouldn't have known so many things. Like, you know, we would, you know, those people in their ivory towers wouldn't have known, you know, how black people were being treated.
Well, it's like, I think it was Will Smith that was talking about this. He said, the whole interaction between the police and African-Americans has not gotten worse. We just have cameras.
Yes.
Like, everybody's got a camera now.
Yeah.
It was like, it's gotten better. It's just that it's everybody's taking pictures now of it, and you're now getting to see it. And I think that what is really powerful is the fact that if we let people have the speech, we know how many people out there that are really out there.
Right.
You know, and I think that that's important. You know, I think that, because then we have to figure out that dialogue that makes that work.
Mm-hmm. So we are going to have a guest with our hot topics today. We're going to segue into a somewhat adjacent story. Ajit Pai this week said that he wanted to have some new transparency obligations. That's what he called it. And John Brodkin from Ars Technica. John Brodkin is the senior IT reporter, and he's going to talk about this story. Welcome to the show, John.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what did we hear from Ajit Pai? And more importantly, like, why do we think that we heard this particular thing that he decided to say about Google and Facebook and other big wigs?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, as the chair of the Federal Communications Commission, all he's done really is get rid of regulations. And now all of a sudden he's suggesting new regulations for companies that he doesn't regulate. And he suggested that they should have some sort of transparency rules around their privacy policies and their, like, free speech policies. And this happens to be the exact same argument that all the companies he regulates have been making, like Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon. They see themselves as competitors to Google and Facebook because they want to get a piece of the advertising market. And so they've been clamoring for more regulations of these companies. And the chair of the Federal Communications Commission just happens to completely agree with them.
And so part of this... has to do with Mike Masnick from TechDirt got accidentally emailed some talking points. Can you talk a little bit about what those talking points said and what he learned from them?
Yeah, well, we didn't really learn anything new. It's just sort of funny that they accidentally emailed their internal talking points to a reporter. But anyway, it's kind of the same thing they've been saying, that websites pose a greater threat to the openness of the internet than internet providers do. That's what the internet providers are saying. And so their argument against net neutrality and privacy rules has generally been that websites should have to face just as onerous regulations as the internet providers.
Which it's kind of odd because it seems like a kind of an apple and orange kind of thing, because the regulations that they have to deal with are completely different than the regulations that the internet, you know, the platforms versus the infrastructure, I guess. But it's like two different worlds. It's like saying that I don't even have an answer.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, obviously, you know, Comcast and Charter combined, there are like 68 million Americans who their only choice for high-speed internet is either Comcast or Charter. So these companies control your entire connection to the internet. They could block or throttle any of these websites entirely. So it's not that there aren't serious issues related to Google and Facebook and Twitter. It's just that it's different. You know, it's the infrastructure versus, you know, the web platforms. Trying to draw like a total parallel between them, it doesn't really work. Like to have the same rules for both.
It's kind of like talking about driving regulations and restaurant regulations. I mean, they don't cross over at all.
Yeah, I mean, different industry. You can't just take, you know, regulations for banking and apply them to any other industry because they're industry specific.
Exactly.
And when you're talking about privacy, I mean, the case could be made that you need to use Google, but you don't need to use Facebook and you don't need to use Twitter. But to get online, you need an ISP. And like you said, a lot of people in a lot of places don't have much of a choice.
Right. And there were some basic privacy rules that were put in place by the previous FCC, which required the ISPs to get your consent before they use or share or sell your web browsing histories and for their advertising businesses. And Congress got rid of that. You know, Ajit Pai opposed it, so he supported that decision to get rid of those rules.
And doesn't it, as we move to 5G, and the providers theoretically have a much bigger, a much clearer vision of who you are, this becomes more important, right? Because you're not going to have Comcast at home and T-Mobile at, you know, on your phone. You're just going to have, you know, AT&T or Comcast or T-Mobile, and it's going to be, you're not going to have Wi-Fi routers. You're just going to have five. I mean, that's the theory. That's the dream, right?
I mean, I don't know about that. I don't think 5G is really a surveillance thing. It's not a surveillance thing.
No, I don't mean a surveillance thing. I mean that's you're not splitting up your service as much. You know, right now I don't think of my home service as the same as my cell service. I mean, I guess people who use AT&T do, but I mean, I don't have the same things, and so they have a vision of me in one place and a vision of where I go and
I think in like rural areas where they don't want to build out fiber, AT&T and Verizon are talking about 5G home broadband. If you already have a fiber connection at home or cable, I think you'll still end up with a separate home internet and wireless.
So you're not arguing that it doesn't make sense for Congress to look into Facebook or Twitter or Google, right?
No, I said in my story, you know, there are good reasons for Congress to look at it. I'm not proposing any particular rules. And Pai's proposal, it was very vague. He just said there should be new transparency rules. So I was just observing that, you know, he's adopting the exact lobbying points of the industry that he regulates while they're trying to compete against these other companies and, you know, ask Congress for new regulations. So he's taken the broadband lobby's argument. He's just taken it and advanced it, you know, under his own name.
So a few weeks ago, we talked about how Verizon had throttled some firefighters out here in California during some wildfires. And I wish they were wildflowers. That would be nice.
We've got another wildflower. 280 acres of wildflowers.
So what's going on with? Some people argue that without net neutrality, it's Ajit Pai's fault that this happened. But what's going on with that story?
Well, the latest thing is that Democratic lawmakers have asked the FCC to investigate whether Verizon, even though there's no rule against throttling, whether Verizon violated the rule on what, you know, being honest with customers about their plans. Because the issue here was that firefighters bought an unlimited data plan. They'd had some problems before. They thought they solved it with Verizon. And then when they went to fight the largest wildfire in California's history, they got throttled again. So the question is whether Verizon gave them enough information about the limits of their supposedly unlimited data plan before it was throttled, you know, during this crucial time.
It's sort of a metaphor.
It does seem like it would be just good PR for Verizon just to ask them for a list of phone numbers and open it up. Like, why do we have to have this conversation in public? You know, that's a middle manager not doing his job.
Right.
You know, like of not making the right play on the field. Of, you know, just quietly call them, give me all the phone numbers, and that is something that somebody can do in Verizon. You know, like they can just sit there. They could have just identified all the phone numbers and just opened them up.
It was the machinery and stuff that right.
It was, I don't know if it's a phone.
But they
or
all
a
have phone
spot,
numbers. So you, everything that connects to Verizon wirelessly has a phone number.
Oh, sure. This was a fire department plan that was on a fire engine that they were using as a command and control center.
But everything, even if it's your MiFi, even anything that's connected via cellular internally somewhere, hidden in some little place, is a phone number that identifies
it. Yeah, Verizon says they have a policy of unthrottling public safety agencies when they're contacted during emergencies, and they didn't do that in this case.
Mm. Verizon didn't, or they didn't contact them?
The firefighters contacted them and said, you know, lift these speed caps immediately, and the answer from Verizon was, you need to spend more money.
Whoa, got it.
And then their excuse was that it was a middle manager who said, who
say
didn't
something,
know.
Doing something stupid. Yeah. See, as I said, customer the mechanics support. Are all there, yeah. It's just an idiot.
Yeah, customer was, service.
You know, like, just probably yeah. one idiot that will be not working at Verizon much longer, hopefully.
So what's your beat at Ars Technica, John?
I covered telecom from a few different aspects, the government policy, the technology, and customer service.
Well, you have lots of good pieces up there. Go to Ars Technica to find out all of John's writing. And where's the best place to follow you? What's your Twitter handle?
Oh, it's Jay Brodkin. I don't know if it's really the best place to follow me, but I am there.
Okay.
Just, you know, the stories I stand behind more than the tweets.
Okay, good. You stand behind the stories, the tweets, who knows? Okay. Well, if you want stories that nobody stands behind, follow Jay Brodkin on Twitter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
We'll talk to you soon. All right. Well, if you are afraid to get a new drone because you're afraid of crashing it, as many...
I wasn't afraid. I just crashed them. Yeah. A lot of them.
Well, you're a different story. I'm afraid of crashing them. But Jason Howell also was afraid of crashing them. He went to a place called Skydio, and he talked to the CEO, and he learned about their technology. And you are going to learn about that technology. But first, before you get to learn about that, you get to hear about CashFly, because CashFly is the sponsor of this episode of the Screensavers.
And they're awesome.
They are awesome. We, Twit, you've been
we've
using
been
u- them.
We've used them since the beginning of the internet. Almost, that's what it feels like anyway. So.
And when was the last time you woke up in the middle of the night because your CDN experienced another outage?
Yeah. Not me. I'm getting CashFly.
Yeah. So if you don't want to spend any time thinking about your CDN, you just don't. You have other better things to think about. With unreliable tech support, every second your site is down, is money being lost on your watch? And CashFly has reliable tech support. They don't have unreliable tech support. And if you're the one to answer the tough questions about your CDN coverage, that's no picnic, especially when you can't even predict your own CDN costs because of unpredictable usage-based bills. Make the switch. CashFly has been building trusted CDN relationships since 2002. CashFly eliminates CDN outages, helps customers reach new markets, and controls costs for all of their customers. They guarantee 100% availability with their bulletproof 100% SLA, supported by an expert team of smart, easy-to-talk-to, and agile techs that can answer all your questions the first time without having to pass you around to five different departments. If you're in software or podcasting like we are, or any other business that relies on having your content readily available to your consumers, it's hard to predict bandwidth consumption for the month. Even worse, it's frustrating when companies try to lock you into a contract that isn't flexible and is not built around your unique demand and traffic patterns. Make this the last month your CDN bill gives you a headache. Say goodbye to logging in multiple times a week, or worse, even daily, trying to track your CDN usage. On average, customers who switch to CashFly save more than 20%. Just imagine what you could do with that 20%. And with all your extra time, when you don't have to micromanage your usage or worry about having to commit to a long contract based on a growth plan that you didn't even write. That is a crazy way to buy a CDN. Don't do that. We have been hosting all of our podcasts, our audio and video on CashFly for nearly a decade. Every month, our viewers and listeners download petabytes of data fast and flawlessly. Twit literally would not exist without CashFly. Join the thousands of others who trust CashFly's reliable network and let CashFly give you some sanity back. I have an exclusive offer just for Twit listeners. CashFly is giving away a complimentary detailed analysis of your current CDN bill and usage trends. See if you might be leaving 20% or more on the table. Learn more at twit.cashfly.com. That's twit.cashfly.com. And we thank CashFly for their support of the new screensavers. All right. Jason is going to show us his self-flying camera that, well, it's not his. It's Skydio's, but he got to play with it. Let's take a look.
We made the trek from Petaluma down to Redwood City to check out Skydio's awesome technology, truly autonomous drone technology, and we're going to put it to the test. We're here with CEO and co-founder of Skydio, Adam Bry. How's it going, Adam?
Good. Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. Tell us about the R1 and kind of where you've come from the Founders Edition, to where you're at right now. Really exciting time.
Yeah, definitely. So the basic idea for the company and the product is pretty simple. Like, we think drones have enormous potential across a bunch of different industries and applications, but it seems like the thing that's really going to make all that stuff work is full autonomy. Like, you need to be able to trust the device to fly itself, which is a very simple concept, but it's an extremely challenging thing to deliver on, and that's what we've been focused on since we've got started. So I have an R1 with us here today. This has been designed for full autonomy from the ground up. So it has 13 cameras on it. It has two facing in every direction. So you can see the pair on the top, each of the sides. There's also two on bottom. And then this is the user video camera out front. So, you know, we have a bunch of sensing in every direction. And then we have a super powerful computer in here as well. This is the NVIDIA TX1 computer. But the real magic is, of course, in the software. We call it the Skydio Autonomy Engine. And it's really this incredibly sophisticated system that processes information from all the cameras. It understands the environment around it, so it knows the 3D structure, it knows semantic information, so it knows people, cars, sky, stuff like that. And then it uses all that information to make intelligent decisions. So it's a very sophisticated device, but the goal for it, like the end product experience, is super simple. It's basically like a film crew that fits into your backpack.
So one big difference here, I think, with a lot of other drone manufacturers, drone products, is that you're not shipping this with a controller. You pulled out your smartphone. Tell us a little bit about the idea to do that. You've got a lot of confidence that this thing can do what it does with just a smartphone.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the kind of thing that would only make sense if you can trust the drone to fly
itself.
Absolutely. And one of our big design goals here is to make it so that if you're comfortable using the camera app on your phone, you should be able to comfortably use this to capture amazing footage. So you can take off from your hand, and it's smart enough to know if it's safe to take off. So, for example, if I point it over at you here, it'll say obstruction ahead, so it won't let me do it.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah. And to test this out, we have Nicole, who leads our flight testing team.
Hi, Nicole.
So she is used to pushing the vehicle to the limits. So I just swipe up to take off.
Starts to spin.
Whoa!
Now, what is it programmed to do at this very moment? Is it just programmed to kind of step out and point towards us onto us?
Exactly. So it took off from her hand, so it knows to start tracking her. So that little orbit symbol there tells us that it's locked onto her. And right now it's in follow mode, which is the default mode. So if she runs around, you can see it start to track her.
Oh, that is neat. That is really cool. And it's tracking through the trees. It's avoiding all of these obstacles automatically, even though she's running through them.
So if you watch her run around, like, it knows where it's safe to fly. It'll weave around the trees. It ducks under everything.
Obviously really great for sports. Skateboarding.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, really any kind of outdoor activity becomes a lot of fun with a drone involved. So, like, hiking, biking, skiing. But even stuff just like playing with your kids in your backyard is pretty cool.
Yeah. How long can the R1 stay in the air before having to come down and, I guess, I'm imagining swap out the battery or charge it?
So the flight time is about 16 minutes. It depends a little bit on what you're doing. There are a couple of other modes we can show you. So some of these are new, we're launching today, but I'll first show you lead mode. So in lead mode, it predicts where Nicole is going and it tries to stay in front of her. So here we're in lead. So see, she's going in that direction.
And that corrects almost immediately. It like sends the command, the drone gets in place. And yeah, look at that. It's staying right in front of her. When she turns, obviously it has to do a bigger correction to get back out in front. That is amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
That is really cool.
Here, I'm going to stop following now. I'll show you some of the one shots, which are new things we've created. So we'll tap on...
You can see the targeting. That's
yes,
really cool.
So we can see the targeting.
Yeah.
So if I tap on you now, it's following you.
Oh, dear.
And then we're going to do a droney here. So a droney's a pretty fun perspective setting shot. So I'll just tap droney. We get the countdown.
Yep.
3, 2, 1.
Oh,
yeah, there you go.
That is so neat. And so it does the out, and then it comes back.
Exactly.
Back in. Now, I'm obviously seeing from my vantage point, you know, it's adjusting. It's a little bit of a breeze here.
Yep.
But everything inside of the camera is counterbalancing for that. So you end up with pretty still shots as a result, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's actually two levels of stabilization, and one of these is new with this software update. So the gimbal is mechanically stabilized. So if you look at the camera out front, it keeps itself level.
Yep.
But then we also do software stabilization, which is new. So let's do another droney here.
All right.
So we'll do droney again, and I can actually control the settings. Let's, I say I want to go really far away, and I want it to go even faster.
Really far away in this case is 262 feet. Wow, and then it kicks in, and there it goes, and hopefully it sees those trees, which it's going to because of all the onboard cameras.
Yeah, exactly. So that's one of the keys here. Like, these one-shots become much more useful if with collision avoidance, because you can just do it with complete reckless abandon.
Right.
And trust it to avoid obstacles and do whatever it needs to do to make the shot work.
So this is obviously the kind of thing that you then do, put out on Instagram or something like
yeah,
that, so everybody yeah. can marvel at
exactly.
so, what you can do.
Yeah, it's super fun. It basically creates these just like perfect Instagrammable shots. So the other thing that's pretty cool is that these will actually keep following you if you move during the one shot. I'm going to do a rocket.
So when you lock to a person, even though it's doing its own pattern, it's still tracking that particular person. So if they move, it continues that pattern but scales it differently depending on where they are.
Exactly. So you'll see it'll shoot up in the air here, but it'll keep looking at her. So here we see it tracking
her.
And then when it's done with the rocket, it'll come back down to wherever she is.
That is amazing. That is super impressive.
And then the other thing we can do, which is new, is called cable cam. So here I can set two positions. So I'll say that's a position and then fly over here.
Do like a manual control to reposition it somewhere.
And say that's the B position.
It's like a tracking shot.
Exactly. And so I click go and it'll smoothly go back and forth between those two shots. Which can make, you can set up, like, even with this, like, really simple primitive, you can get these, like, amazingly smooth, cool, like, landscape kind of stuff. And then, if we want, we can set it to follow subject. If I tap on Nicole, so if she moves now, it'll follow her, but it'll stay on that line that I've given it. And so this becomes really useful, like, if you're filming a soccer game or something, you can set this up on a sideline. And it basically gets this sort of perfect sideline tracking shot.
That is really impressive.
Yeah. I mean, this is the kind of thing where, like, you know, to create something like this previously, you'd be talking about a film crew with, like, a dolly and a bunch of equipment, and this is literally, like, three taps on an app.
The idea, I mean, obviously we have technology that allows us to do this now. You're demonstrating that. Would you say that creators are, like, your number one kind of target for this technology? It's creators, filmmakers, that sort of thing?
I think that's definitely a major category for us. Like, we think of this as really a new kind of camera. Like, it's a camera that you don't have to point and control yourself. It's a camera that controls itself. And we think, you know, athletes, people who do interesting, cool stuff outside, that's a major use case and customer group for us. And then also creative people who have this idea of this kind of shot and want to be able to create content. But being able to do that without having to hire and run a whole crew is super, super powerful. We're running a bit low on battery here, so I'll stop tracking her, and then I can click return to phone now here. It's using my phone's GPS signal to come back into the general area. So GPS isn't accurate enough to do super tight following, but it is enough to get it to just return to the general vicinity.
When the R1 knows that it's about to run out of battery and you as the operator don't do anything specifically, does it automatically come over and land before it knows it's about to run out entirely?
Yeah, so it we have a couple layers of intelligence built in, so it detects when the battery is running low. It'll let you know that on the phone. And then if the battery gets too low, it'll land itself. And it has an intelligent landing mode where it'll look for a flat place that it thinks it's safe to touch down.
One thing I really like about what you guys are doing here, and we kind of briefly mentioned it earlier, is this idea that regular software updates that bring major
features, right? Like this, you initially released the Frontier Edition in February. You had a very major software update that happened in May. That brought a bunch of new functionality.
Yeah.
And now, of course, the new announcement, it brings a whole host of other things.
Yep.
Like, that just seems to open up the door for, like, unlimited kind of expandability down the line. It's a great, that's a great way to approach this.
Yeah, exactly. It's really a software-defined experience. And with the hardware, we've built something that is capable of doing all the sensing and compute you need. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, the software defines what the device does, which is really extremely exciting. So, you know, the new capabilities we're announcing today, we think are really cool and open up a lot of new use cases. And then, as you mentioned, there's kind of this infinite expandability aspect to that. And so we're also excited to be announcing an SDK, which we think is an enormously powerful thing because it takes all of the problems we've solved in autonomous navigation and makes the solutions to those available for developers to create whatever kind of behavior they want. So to enable that, we have a web simulator environment. So it's actually all based in the browser, and you can just go to our developer console, create your skill. It's all done in Python. You know, a few hundred lines of Python, you can create some incredibly powerful stuff. You can test it out in sim in the browser, and then you can very easily deploy it to your vehicle or a set of vehicles that you want.
All right. You ready? Come on.
And another part of this also is the mobile aspect, right? Like, you obviously, you have a great app to kind of control all this stuff, but that's opening up as well, right?
Yeah, there are some use cases, and I think this is especially true on the commercial side, where let's say you want to do roof inspection. You know, there's a particular interface and workflow that's going to be best for roof inspection, and that's a mobile-defined experience. So if people want, in addition to writing their own skills that run on board, they can create their own mobile app to interface. And you know, we expect that, especially in the commercial space, this is going to be a really powerful thing where people can create their own enterprise workflows using our core system, but completely done in whatever way makes the most sense for their customers.
Can you share, like, maybe one or two kind of interesting ideas that they've come up with that maybe you're looking forward to?
Yeah, so I think there's a few different buckets of use cases, all of which are pretty exciting to us. There's a ton of stuff that kind of revolves around inspection, being able to put a camera at a specific point in space in a reliable, precise way without worrying about it crashing. And I think that covers everything from, like, residential roofs to large commercial spaces to energy infrastructure, so, like, oil pipelines, power plants, cell towers, stuff like that, wind farms. So there's a lot of interest in all these areas, and some of it is working today with manually flown products, but it's a lot more cumbersome than you'd want it to be. And the vision here is that it's basically like push-button autonomy. Like, you know, you push a button, or maybe you don't even push the button, just on regularly scheduled intervals, the drones can go off and perform these tasks. And we think that's, you know, that's the core of what we can enable here. And then there's, you know, there's complete other categories of stuff around security. So one of the really cool things is that this product can respond to the environment around it. So you could build an app that looks for particular types of objects. If it sees it, it could track those and catalog them. And then there's also, I think, a lot of cool consumer app-oriented stuff to be done. You could imagine building something that was great for filming soccer games and knew how soccer games work and knew the right angles so that your kid's soccer game could be produced as if it was on ESPN. And I think one of the things that's exciting for us is we just see enormous opportunity basically in every direction to make these things better and smarter and more useful and more use cases.
Droning.
If you draw analogies to other industries like personal computing or phones, I think we're still in sort of day zero of the industry. And the things that drones can do in 1 year and 2 years and 5 years and 10 years, I think will be astounding relative to what's out there today, even in something like this, which is the most advanced product of the time.
Ah! That is awesome.
All right, Adam Bry, CEO, co-founder of Skydio, thank you so much, man. This was a lot of fun, and I'm so super psyched for you guys.
This has been great. Thanks.
I can't wait to get my own.
You go.
I still want that.
I want to see I want to see your Instagrams of that. The Droneo.
I know. Droney.
Do a Droney.
Oh, yeah. That's...
Yeah, I liked it.
As someone who has crashed a lot of drones, I'm really excited about
not having one that crashes.
Mm-hmm. That was also a little scary when it was just following the woman running.
With a good music bed, yeah. That would be really scary.
So Leo's gone, so we've turned this into a cooking show.
Yeah, exactly. we said tech. Yeah.
These are, Leo and I did a tech cooking segment, but you have mostly different things. And you have some of the same things, but some that you use them very differently, which I think is interesting.
All the time. So, I mean, this is, I cook a lot, but I'm not a really highly technical cook. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I just know how to make things. And so the idea, what I was trying to think about are things that I use that just make it easier. Like, this isn't about becoming, you know, the next Gordon Ramsay. This is about your meals are easy. You don't have to think about them and they're good.
Yes.
You know, that's, that kind of makes them great. So, the one that I got introduced to in Japan, I worked on a movie in Japan for 6 weeks, and so they put me in an apartment. And in the apartment, I think every household in Japan has a Zojirushi. Sorry.
Yes.
I'm good like at looking that. At it and knowing it. Zojirushi. And it is, this is a, it's a really smart rice cooker. So if we open it up here, you'll see the rice is done. Ooh. It sang us a little song earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And what's cool about it is that you literally take this little cup and you fill it up and you decide, I want one of these cups or two of these cups or three of these cups. And then you've got these little numbers that come up the side. And that just tells you where to put the water. So you put the cup in, you fill the water to the right line, you know, and it has all the different kinds of, you know, whether it's sweet or brown or jasmine or white or in this case, sushi rice. And it just, you close it, you select what kind of rice you have on the front, and then you hit start, and it just, off it goes. You know, and then you walk away, and you don't think about it. And literally, it'll keep the rice moist and ready to eat all day. Now, it's best when it just comes out. This was done a little earlier, so we'll pull some of this, and I'll not put it in there. So, but what you're going to notice is for sushi rice, you know, it's nice and moist.
Mm-hmm.
If we take a little butter.
Oh, butter.
Butter. That's good. But if we mix that in a little bit, what we really need is some...
chopsticks.
You know, chopsticks, yeah, exactly. But you can see how it's nice and moist. It's kind of just the way you'd expect it.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if it's very Japanese to put butter in your
I don't
rice,
think
but,
it is, but
but
that's
I'm
okay.
doing it anyway, because I'm, you know, 1 foot in, 1 foot out, right? So anyway, but... Here, try some.
Okay. Tastes good.
And you didn't have to think about it at all.
No, that's what
I like.
We
didn't have to think about time. We didn't have to think about anything else. We filled the cup to the top. Good. We filled the water to the line. We shut it and hit start.
Right, and then we did something else.
And we went away and just never thought about it again. And at the end, during the show, we heard it sings a little song.
Mm-hmm.
So it sings a little song, tells you your rice is done. And if you're not ready right then, you just leave it there for a little while longer. I'd really like things that are precise about what they do,
uh-huh.
So that I don't have to be precise about what I do.
That's so smart.
You know, so the other one that I use a lot is I use the Innova. And I have lots of different sous vide cookers. I got the first one that was like a box. It was like the Supreme, and it was like a box you put stuff in. And then I've got a couple different other versions of it. But I've been the happiest with the Innova, and I admit that I have a couple. the reason is that what the Innova is good at, and you probably talked about it on your other segment, is or what a sous vide cooker is good at, is that it's very precise about the temperature. You don't have to be very precise about the time. So that what that means is that we have friends coming over, and I want to have a steak right when they get over there, or I want to be ready for that. I don't have to worry about when I start that steak.
Mm-hmm.
When they come over, we'll sit, we'll say hi, we'll grab a beer, and I'll throw this and cook it in minutes, 2 or 3 minutes, and it's going to be great because the whole thing has been cooked. Essentially, how the sous vide works is that the water is at a certain temperature, your steak is at a different temperature. As you leave the steak in, or the steak, the chicken, the vegetables, the salmon, as you leave it in there longer, it essentially, the meat equalizes temperature with the water. So end to end, it's whatever temperature you set. So in this case, I set it to 128 degrees Fahrenheit. That means the whole steak after an hour is at 128 degrees. Now, the only thing that happens when I leave it longer is that it gets softer, because basically the heat is denaturing the protein. And if you... So what happens is, like, we left it in here for an hour, so we'll try it after an hour. For, like, a tri-tip, my My wife likes it at about 36 hours. I like it at about 24 hours. If you leave it at 48 hours, I think it gets a little mealy because it gets soft. Mm-hmm. And I have found if you leave it for 3 weeks, it turns into liquid.
Why would you leave it for three weeks?
I would love to say that it was an experiment. I just wanted to see what would happen. But I put it in, and I had the Supreme, which is closed, doesn't make any noise. Uh-huh. I put it in, and I was in a rush the next day. I went to Europe. And I came back, and it was still on.
You didn't remember that you didn't eat your steak?
There was a lot of things going on. I was going to eat it that evening, and then I realized, oh, I got to leave that evening.
Yeah.
And then I just didn't think about it again. There's a lot of a lot of things going on in my head, mm-hmm. and so things get left behind.
So none of this technology is going to remind you to eat.
No.
Okay.
No, it's just going to be. But when you remember, it's there waiting for you. You know.
Yeah.
And so the great thing is that, and again, like if you're doing a barbecue, what's great is you might put two or three steaks in there, and so whenever you feel like having another one, you just pull it out. There's a couple different ways of heating it. I brought a blowtorch. We'll play with that in a second. Mm. You can also throw it on a hot pan. So you can get a cast iron pan and get it up to 500 degrees and throw it on there and sear it. Because when it comes out, you'll see that it looks a little like a science experiment. Mm-hmm. But you just got to caramelize that outside area. The best way to do it is a big green egg or some version of that, where you're basically get it up to 800, 900 degrees, throw it in for a minute on each side, and you're done. And it'll be the best steak you've ever had, and you didn't have to do anything. So let me show you how you do it. This is the part that gets people caught up, is they buy this part, right? They've seen the Innova stuff. They buy it, and then if they're smart, the first thing that everybody does is they buy this, and then they start using it with their pots. then there's like a pot, because they advertise, like, this is all you need, right? It's not all you need. So the way to do this is you get this, and this is now down to 70 bucks or 80 bucks or something. It's not very expensive. When I bought it, it was more expensive. Not that I'm bitter. And then I got this. This is a Rubbermaid 12 quart. And if you buy this on Amazon, it'll say, hey, would you like one of these? And the answer is yes. Yes, you would. And then...
What does it come with this?
This is a Sovita. And when you buy this, it will say, hey, do you want this? And the answer, you won't say yes the first time, and you wish you had. So what this does is it keeps the temperature. It'll use less energy with this if you have this to insulate it a little bit. And then there's a top that I forgot to bring in, which is that you put it over and it keeps the water from evaporating. So those are the kind of fool things. And then some people, if they're going to do something for a long period of time, actually have cut holes in igloos and stuck this into the thing, because then it really keeps the water where you want it to be. And that has nothing to do with the quality of the sous vide. It just has to do with how much energy you're using to keep it at that temperature. So you get this little kit. And this is all going to, together, all of these are going to be about $100, $9,500. Then I have bought very big and expensive vacuum sealers, mm-hmm. And this one's just fine.
How much is that one?
This one's like 70 bucks or 50 bucks. It's like $50 to $70, depending on where you see it. It's made by some Chinese company, and the name up here changes about every 6 months.
But
if you look at this form factor, this is what it should be. So this is a vacuum sealer. I'm just going to open it up. And there's a couple things that catch people. The first thing is this is a roll of vacuum seal. So basically it's just one long roll. And this is the way to do this, because instead of trying to figure out which Ziploc to use or what bag, you just make it as long. If you have a tri-tip, you need this much. If you have a little steak, you need this much. So you just decide what you need. You take the open end and you put it in here. You put it right in between here and you just close this. And you have to close it on both ends. And then you just hit seal. Don't hit vacuum and seal. Big mess. So when the little light goes off here, it'll be done. I don't know what it's taking so long. There we go. So when you open it up, now it's closed off that. Using heat, it's closed that off.
Could you just use like an iron or something?
You could. It'd get really sticky.
Okay.
You know, because... I'm sure you could if you wanted to, but I think it would be a very sticky thing to do. And you wouldn't be able to use the iron for anything other than this after
you started. I don't use it for anything else anyway. Well,
then, exactly. So... All right, so then you cut it, and so you just cut the length, and I've got a little steak in here that I grabbed at Rayleigh's on the way here. So you take your steak, and, well, what you would normally do is put it on a plate, but I'm just going to stick it in here now. And then I use a lot of different kind of salts. This is salt. We talked about this. This is the same salt. We use this little Maldon sea salt.
Yeah,
these
I have
are
that at home.
Flakes, and the flakes tend to work really well with the steak. When you're doing it, and I'm making a big mess with the salt. Sorry in advance.
It's okay.
Anyway, so then you get some salt on here, and you want to get it on both sides. And this, I usually do it on a plate, but I just realized I don't really have it quite set up right, so I'm just going to do it this way. I'm going to get salt all over this table and in the electronics, and John is going to hate that.
Okay, what's this?
This is espresso Brava salt. We're not going to use it on this one, but it is so good. So you can add this to the steak, and it actually gives it a whole different kind of taste.
Can you use this on other stuff? Because I don't actually eat steak, so...
You can use it on all kinds of things that you would use salt on.
Eat it straight?
Yeah, okay. You can.
I'll do that.
That might give you a little buzz, too. Okay. Like, yeah, and so anyway, then I like to add a little, you know, like a little twig of rosemary for the, you know, to set it up. So you stick it in there.
Oh, you don't even break it up. You just stick it in there.
Stick it in there with there. Now, this is what everyone screws up when they buy it the first time. They put it way up here.
Oh.
And then they're like, it doesn't work. Every single person I've ever given one of these to, it's a lot of people, they always say it doesn't work. And so you have to get it right in because this is the gap that's pulling the oxygen out.
Uh-huh.
So then you push this in and you hit.
Whoa.
It's thinking about it. And then so what it does, it sucks all the oxygen out and then immediately seals the end. And so now you have, it's ready to go. And the reason you need to do this is because you need the water to be completely touching the surface of this object. If there's air in there, number one is you could, it's a great breeding ground for bad things if you're going to leave it there for a long time.
Like 3 weeks.
Yeah, like 3 weeks or 2 days. but it also means that the water is completely touching all of this and you don't have big air gaps. And the biggest thing is that it floats. So if you throw it in there and you have air oxygen in it, it'll float to the top and then there's this constant issue. So anyways, you take that, and we had one that we put in before the show.
Okay. You want the plate?
Yeah, sure, we'll grab one of these plates here. So this is the, sorry, I'm making a really big mess here.
That's okay, we don't have to clean it up.
Excellent. So then you take this guy and you just throw him in there, right? And then we find our scissors.
I have to say, that doesn't look that good.
It doesn't, not until you're... Oh, you don't eat steak either, so it's
right.
Not, you're
but
gonna
I
be
mean,
like,
even when I used to, no, like, it you, looks a little...
No, because it hasn't been seared. So you're used to seeing it seared by the time it does this. Like, usually fire has affected it, right? And to someone who doesn't have steak, does it really gross you out to have steak near you?
No. I mean, even if you loved steak, like, this looks weird, right? It looks like a little moldy.
I know. As I said earlier, it'll look like a science experiment. So then what you... Celery and carrots is just the base of a soup. All right, so anyway, this is the easiest way to do it when we don't have anything else to be really hot.
Should we have safety goggles? I guess not.
Sure. I think safety goggles would be a great idea. If only we had some safety goggles, we'd be safe now. But instead, we're living on the edge. So now... My kids, the nice thing about doing it this way is that it is a lot more fun at parties.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, my kids, if I did this once, I think, for one of my kids, like, where their friends came over, and they only wanted the sous vide because they wanted to, they wanted me to do this in front of their friends.
Right, they wanted you to wield fire.
And they wanted to do it in front of their friends, and I was like, let's talk about that.
It smells really good. Can you make bacon with this?
Oh, yeah, you can make bacon. So I make a bacon sandwich, egg, bacon, and cheese sandwich for my kids for breakfast. And I cook Black Forest for about a day in the sous vide. And then you cook it for like a minute on each side. And it is just, it's a super soft. Because remember, everything just gets softer. So there you go. So now it looks more like a steak, right?
Yeah, it does. It does. It looks much better.
Yeah.
It looks
and
great.
So, but the cool thing is that when we, and normally we would flip it, I'll flip it and we'll do it just a little bit on the other side.
Is this healthier in any way?
I don't know if it's healthier or not. I know that it just tastes a lot better and I don't have the time to figure out how to do it well. It was funny, I forgot to turn the sous vide on one time and I had to explain to someone, I was like, I don't think you understand. I don't know how to cook it without a sous vide. Like, I don't know how to cook steak without a sous vide. Like, I know how to do this. You know, now we're going to leave it. It's going to look a little like a science experiment on one side.
Okay.
And then I'm going to just cut it just so you see that.
Then it's cooked.
It's cooked. I'm not. Let's see.
Fork?
I need
we
a fork.
Don't, we
I
don't have a
fork. Here, I'm just going to grab it like this.
You have a spoon.
I asked for a lot of things, and I forgot to ask for that. So what you see, though, is that if we look at it from the side, I don't know if you can see that there, but so what you have is this perfect medium rare steak that's from end to end, it is medium rare. You know, and then so then you just you get the caramelization on the outside, or you get the searing on the outside, so it tastes like that steak. But you're not. It's normally when you have it, when you've cooked it. I don't think you want any steak, but
no, I don't. But
normally when you cook it, you'll have this center part. It's just this little center part will be red, and the rest of it will be cooked at different levels. This one, because we, you know, it's just seared on the outside and it's medium rare all the way through. So I wouldn't suggest a sous vide if you really want it to be well done. But I wouldn't suggest eating steak if you really want it to be well done.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway.
And then can we use this thing
now,
too?
Yeah, so this is... The last bit is this is a laser measure. This one's made by E-Tech City, but these are some version of a... You know, there's again, it's a Chinese company that makes it for lots of people, so there's lots of different names for it. And all this does is you point it at the steak, and it'll tell us exactly. This is still 124 degrees, 120, 25, 26, move it around. So... What I use this for is not so much for this. I use it when I'm cooking with pans because I want to know exactly. I make a lot of, I like omelets. And so I make a lot of omelets. Well, not a lot, but one every morning.
That's a lot.
And so one every morning, but it's slightly different. You know, some have cheese omelets. I make a pizza omelet. I make a real foamy omelet. I make lots of different kinds of omelets. And the big thing is that by constantly sampling the pan, and this thing is like $15. It's not like this is not an expensive thing to have. So literally, anyway, anywhere I think I'm going to cook, I tend to put it in. Because again, I don't know how to do it without it. Like I don't know what medium heat is. I just know 240 degrees, 325 degrees. I know that I like to make most of my omelets at 340 degrees. I know I like to make my scrambled eggs at 260 degrees. I know, you know, and so you get used to having that precision. And what happens is you sample it while you're cooking it, and then you learn, 425 degrees is too hot to cook an omelet. it burns on the outside and doesn't cook on the top.
Well, if you're making chicken, too, you'd want to know it was fully cooked, right?
Yes, although I even sous vide my chickens.
Right.
You can put a whole Cornish hen in there, in just in case you're wondering. It's kind of good.
What about a turkey?
I have not put a whole turkey in. The Cornish hen is about as big as I've been able to get the vacuum pack to work.
The turkey,
I know that Andy Anako cuts his up and puts it in pieces and then cooks it there. So I do, for my turkeys, I do deep fat fry. I mean, I do oil and...
That's another episode, the deep fat fryer. But I like this because if you have a meat thermometer, you stick it in.
Well, the problem is that's not going to be... A meat thermometer is going to tell you something different than this. This is going to tell you the surface temperature. So if you're measuring your chicken or your turkey, that's not going to work because you need to get to... You need to go to the deepest area.
That won't go all the way through?
No, because it's just what's at the surface.
Oh.
So you still need
lasers.
A meat thermometer.
I thought lasers could do everything.
Yeah, it's not X-ray lasers.
Okay.
So that one, you need to get to the deepest part of the turkey or chicken to find out what the temperature is. Because the goal is that it's at least it touches 165 degrees. Now, the funny thing is you start sous vide and you realize, I can actually cook a chicken. That 165 is just... For a minute or two. Mm-hmm. With sous vide, if you're going to leave it there for an hour, the chicken can actually be 145 or 150 degrees, which makes it really, really soft. Mm-hmm. But it's still safe because you left it in there long enough to kill everything anyway.
Could you make, like, chicken broth if you did your whole 3 weeks in there or something?
You probably could. I'm now thinking of something I might do next week. I don't know. Anyway, so hopefully these are all things that, again, none of them are very complicated. This isn't something you have to go to school for. If I grew up now and I had a dorm room or I was when I'm in Washington, D.C. working, I kind of feel like a bachelor. And so these are all things that I don't have to think about it. Like another thing I do with the sous vide is I'll throw the steak in the morning. When I come home, I have a dinner. Like, I don't, like, 3 minutes after, I've got a steak dinner that's ready for me rather than whatever chicken. Like, I don't, once I got these things, I stopped getting frozen foods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what bachelors do these days. They sous vide.
Yeah, exactly.
It's amazing. I love it all. I think someone should eat this steak. So,
yeah.
Because that's what makes me sad, if steak gets uneaten. Yes. All right. But we are going to answer someone's question. We're going to answer James from London's question. You're going to answer it.
Next.
Yes, but first we're going to thank Rocket Mortgage. You have heard of us talking about Rocket Mortgage. We've talked about Rocket Mortgage on this show because we love them. If you have bought a house, you know how frustrating it is. Rocket Mortgage takes technology and throws it at a problem, and that problem being not feeling like you have control, just not being able to get all your documents right when you want to buy the house. If you go to an open house and you just have to go home and then call your mortgage broker and do all that stuff, you don't want to do that. They have reinvented the mortgage process and put the power in your hands. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans calling it the power buying process. Here's how it works. Step one, answer a few simple questions. Then they will check your credit for pre-qualified approval. Then Quicken Loans will verify your income, assets, and credit in less than 24 hours to give you verified approval. That's step two. And that gives you the strength of a cash buyer. Step three, once you've verified, you qualify for an all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. First, they'll lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Now, here's the best part. If rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. Either way, you win, which is great right now because rates are going all over the place. It's kind of like the thinking that you would expect from America's largest mortgage lender. So if you want to get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/NSS. Don't forget to add the NSS. That stands for New Screensavers, and that way they know that we sent you there. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/NSS. And we thank Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans for their support of the New Screensavers. And now, it's time for a call for help. Hello, James from London. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I think we're both doing better than you. Tell us what happened.
Okay, so I have a MacBook Pro 2017 model with two devices attached to it, both called storage devices, both called Untitled. And I choose to reformat the key stick, USB key stick, and it reformats the USB key stick and then reformats the 500 gigabyte external hard drive, also called Untitled. So rather usefully. So my question is, can you recommend a piece of software that I can use to recover the please.
Yeah. Well, and my first question is, have you done anything with that drive after? Did you try to copy anything to it or anything else to the drive after you? Because once you've written anything, it's pretty much you start losing a lot of access to stuff.
So I've not written anything to it. I've just kept it safe until I can get the right piece of software.
The one that I've used in the past is called Data Rescue 5, and I think it was Data Rescue 4 when I used it or whatever. But it was Data Rescue, and I think it's about $99. What I did is I had a whole bunch of things that said Untitled, but I was using GoPros. I had six GoPros. It was a little 360 rig, and so I was kind of pulling them out and deleting them, and I deleted the wrong one. So it's kind of the same situation that you had. And so I got Data Rescue. The thing to know is that when it comes back, it's not going to come back in the way that you had it. So all the file structures are gone. So it won't, when it pulls that data back out there, it's going to be all the hidden files and all the file structure. You'll get lots of hidden files you didn't have before, and you'll lose all the file structure that you had before. So getting through that will become a bit of a an adventure.
A sticky wicket?
Yeah, sticky wicket. Yeah. So it works. I mean, I had it work. I was able to get all the files out that I had lost. But the challenge really is that it took a lot of digging because, for instance, the GoPro, it turned out, was saving in segments, and those segments were everywhere and there was things on it. And so you just be ready that finding stuff. You said you have a lot of images and movies on there. Is that mostly what's there?
Yeah, a lot of audio archives, that kind of thing.
The good news is that if it's a certain file type, it's pretty easy to find that file type and then grab them. The thing you'll have trouble with is the project files and the support files, depending on what you're using. Those will be things that are much more difficult to find. But the raw audio files, you can search for AIF or MP3 or AAC or whatever you've recorded them in, and you're going to be able to sort through those because they will be in a file structure when they come back, just not the one that you saw before.
And cool.
I know you know this, James, but for the benefit of everyone else who might not know this, this is a dangerous software category because you're feeling desperate and you're like, oh, I want to recover my data so much. I'll do anything. And I like to call it desperationware. I just made that up. Someone already probably said that. And as you said, like you downloaded a lot of free programs or you looked up a lot of free programs and then looked, you know, did the second step of looking up and they contained a lot of adware. There's a lot of programs that claim to be free, but then they get it and they say, if you want it, then you have to pay us, you know, $300 or something like that. So it's good that Alex has actually used this software. It was also recommended by Macworld. So I know there's lots of free versions, but none.
This is definitely not anything that's touching your hard drive and really digging that deep into it is definitely not something to go cheap on.
Yeah.
Right. Cool. That's a great recommendation. Much appreciated, guys. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, James.
Take care. All right.
Next week, I'm going to be hosting the show. They're going to let me back. I mean, right now, they're going to let me back. We'll see.
Not me. They're like,
no. not you. You're going to be on MacBreak Weekly, right?
Mm-hmm.
They haven't let me on that show. I don't know. Like, I think maybe it's clearly I'm allowed to be near you, so it must be someone else, Renee Ritchie. I don't know. And it's going to be a big week this week.
This week's been busy. We got the Apple event and then MacBreak Weekly.
Yeah, it's going to be. Right. And MacBreak Weekly is going to be
right after the event.
Yeah, so it's going to switch places with Windows Weekly, which for some reason they do let me host. But next week, next Saturday, I'll be hosting with Rich DeMuro. And so I'm very excited because I don't really know, and I haven't gotten him to be able to tell me whether he uses an iPhone or an Android phone on his regular. I think he claims to regularly use an Android phone, but then I've been doing some forensic research and trying to check his tweets to figure out where they're sent from. So I think that's something that we're going to solve
next
week. But if you have a question, here is how you can ask your question.
Need tech help? The new screensavers are here with answers. Email your tech questions to newscreensavers@twit.tv.
It's almost the end of the show. It went by very fast.
It did.
Yeah. I didn't have to use my Leo earmuffs where I have to shut my ears of something he said and shut my eyes. And you know that I would say that to his face, too. I'm not just saying it because he's on vacation. Should we do the mailbag? Ooh. We should really call it a mailbox. Does he say that every time? Oh, look. We got questions, but we also... got, let me see which question is for me and which is for you. Mm-hmm. That one's for you.
Huh?
This one's for me. And then I'll give you that postcard.
Oh, look at that.
It's from Leo saying, don't talk bad about me. I'm listening to you. So he sent these with Bill Atkinson's cards, photo card. And he says, hello, everybody from Seville, Spain. Yesterday was a sea day, so we did nothing but lounge about. It was a perfect non-labor day. Today we traveled to Seville, about an hour and a half from the port of Cadiz, and saw the amazing Plaza de España and the real Alcazar and the palace of the King of Spain. When he's in town, the Alcazar dates back to the 13th century and combines Moorish and Gothic architecture with beautiful gardens and fountains and the most lovely detailed plaster work we've ever seen. On the flip side, just a bit of Seville Cathedral, the largest cathedral in the world, and it's truly awe-inspiring. Tomorrow on to Portugal. Love to you all. He means all of you. There it is. You don't have to read yours aloud unless you want to.
I'll read mine aloud.
Okay.
So this is the picture here. And it says, greetings from Portugal. We're in the seaside resort called Portoreno, I think. Not much to see here except beautiful beaches. September is high season, but the beaches are so huge, they don't seem crowded. The real reason we came here is for the chicken piri-piri. Mission accomplished. We're at the Beachside Cafe, and it's been here since 1976, and the piri-piri is delicious. Tomorrow, our real adventure begins. We're on the road to Morocco. Love you all, Lisa and Leo.
I think they really are on vacation.
I really like these postcards.
They are really nice.
Oh, my gosh, I got to start doing this. This is amazing.
Because he's not posting on social media either. Lisa
right.
is, but he's, Leo's not.
He's going old school.
Yeah.
This is old school with a new school twist.
Yeah.
I like it. Mm-hmm. It's really good.
All right. Do you want to read your question? Good work.
All right. There we go. It says, Alex, I am looking for examples for some video shot on a Samsung 360 round camera, but can't find anything. I have a Rift and would like to see the camera's output in action. It's supposed to be binocular and 360, and might be cool if the price came down a lot. $10,000 is up there. Hard to sell with nothing to see. Any suggestions? Thanks. I love the show. I have been a fan since ZDTV. So I have a friend who has a round camera. So so what we're going to do is we're going to post that up there over the weekend. So by Monday, we'll have it up there, and it'll be pixelcore.com/Samsung360. And so we'll put up a little example file, and people can push it through there. I meant to have it before I talked about it, but I'm going to have it up there.
You had the
on
steak.
Monday.
That's what's important.
I had the steak. I was running around getting the steak and everything else. So we're going to put it up there and show some stereo. We shot most of our stuff with the Ozos, which are do the same kind of thing, but they were more expensive, then they were less expensive, and now they don't exist anymore. So so anyway, but I've got a bunch of them just in case you need them. So anyway, but we'll put it up there. I think that the results that I've heard is that the round camera is great. It is it's very compact. You're pulling those signals basically from Ethernet. It's very easy to use, but otherwise, you know, then it's got good stereo. So I will we'll get that up there, and we'll post it by Monday, and we'll get some samples for you to look at.
All right, I have a question as well. This is from Frederick. He says, my family and I are all in on the Apple ecosystems. We have Macs, iPhones, and iPads. I also pay for iTunes Match, but not Apple Music, because A, I'm old, and I only want to listen to music I've previously purchased on CD, and B, I want to access via the cloud to obscure artists I have in my collection. Does the HomePod support playback from my cloud-based library via iTunes Match, or does it only work with an Apple Music subscription? Now, I, too, have a HomePod and an Apple Music subscription, as you do.
Yep.
But it does work. I did look this up. It does work with iTunes Match, according to Apple and, you know, many people who have tried it. The most important thing is that you have to set up your HomePod with the phone that you already have iTunes Match on. So that's what you have to do in order for it to work. And I was excited to hear this because I recently subscribed to Spotify as well as iTunes, as well as Apple Music, because what I discovered, I have one HomePod and I have 15 devices that can play Spotify, you know, whether it's right. an Amazon Echo or a third-party device or speakers. And what I realized is, you know, you can be in one room, ask, you know, your whatever it is to play a song on Spotify, and then you can go into another room with Spotify Connect and then just, you know, say play Spotify, and it stops the speaker where you were and starts the speaker where you are now.
Right.
So that's pretty nice.
It is. I have to admit that I have my argument is that I'm on a show and I need to keep up with the technology and mm-hmm. everything else, but I have Prime, so I have the Prime collection, mm-hmm. and then I have Spotify, and then I have Apple Music, and for me, Prime is just because it comes with it. You know, I have Prime and everything else. It's a good business model for them.
Yeah.
Spotify I've had since it came out. You know, so mm-hmm. Most of my playlists are all there, and for me, Apple Music is literally just so if I want to yell out, I want to listen to Police Synchronicity, it'll just play it. Not just that one, but
yeah,
you know, but in general, I can just say I want to listen to this album or I want to listen to something, and just the voice activation is worth to me, and, you know, and that one is where I have my family plan, so mm-hmm. my kids can use it and, you know, everything else, and so I think that is so I've kind of used all of them to some degree. I don't know. I find that the experience of building playlists on Spotify is just better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I don't know what it is. It's easier to find things. It's a more fluid place to build playlists. And I publish them from now on then, so it's fun when people listen to my.
Oh, you know, I'm gonna find comments. Your playlists and.
It's I have a pool mix. If you do Alex the Lindsay pool mix.
Okay.
It's like 12 or 13 hours of, like, you can just play it at the pool, listening to the barbecue, and it is literally it goes all over the place because my kids and my wife and I all pick the songs. Mm-hmm. I only get to pick the order. So you'll see stuff that my daughter likes and my son likes and my wife likes, and it's all mixed in there. And so it's a very eclectic pool mix.
Well, so do you have one HomePod? Or do you
have one HomePod.
One HomePod.
In my office.
And do you have Sonos as well?
I have a lot of Sonos. So the house I got came with it. So I have 14 Sonos connects. Or 14 Sonos amps in a little server room, and then they serve all the speakers in the house. So they're all sitting there, all connected. And so so I have, you know, surround sound in two locations, and I've got ones out of the pool and ones in the garden and ones in my kids' room. If I want to wake up the kids, I can just turn music on in their room.
Wow.
so yeah, I have a lot of Sonoses.
That's do they call them Sonai?
I don't know, but that we'd have to ask someone at Sonos if they call them Sonai.
And so you can't speak to those, though?
You cannot speak to those. No, I don't have any way to do that. But you can group them together, and you mm-hmm. can, that, which is really nice when if you have people over, you can kind of group a whole bunch of parts of the house together, because almost every major room has speakers in them. So you can just say, we'd like to listen to the groove mix or something like that. It just plays nice, music in the background.
Do you have a sous vide mix?
I don't, because you don't think about it. You just throw it in the CD.
Yeah, you don't need to.
And then you're off to the races. And
yeah.
So I do have a workout mix, but that's I publish that one too.
Okay, are we friends on Apple Music?
Because on Spotify or
no?
Apple
are
Music?
We friends on Apple Music? Because I don't have any friends on Spotify yet. I just signed up.
I don't think I've ever tried to friend anybody on Apple Music. I didn't even know it did that.
Well, I'm friends with Rene Ritchie, so maybe he doesn't like my music, and that's why I'm not allowed on MacBreak Weekly. I don't know. Maybe. That's why. Maybe we shouldn't be friends.
Well, I think I don't do any of the friend stuff because I don't really want friends to look at what I'm watching, what I'm listening to.
Yeah.
So I don't, if I publish a playlist, I just want to publish the playlist. Like, this is my public, this is what you get to know about what I like as far as music goes. But, the fundamental thing is I just don't want people to know how much I listen to Katy Perry.
Well, that makes sense, yeah. Renee listens to a lot of video game music. I'll tell you. But, that doesn't surprise you, does it?
No. Yeah. No, not at all. Not at all. I can't say that I listen to a lot of anything specific. I listen to a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. My daughter, she listens a lot to Pearl Jam.
Mm. Oh.
9 years old. Pearl Jam, Red Hot Chili Peppers. That's my...
That's good work.
Yeah, she's... My son likes classic violin. And my daughter's the rock and roll. Oh. Rock and roll. Yeah.
Well...
My wife blames me.
That's good. Yeah, my kids have good taste in music. It's
Why?
A lot of musicals.
Why they like musicals?
Yeah,
like they like Hamilton.
They do. Yeah, the 13-year-olds like a lot of Hamilton.
Do they know all the words?
Yeah.
How is that possible?
Like, I don't know.
I can't even. My kids know every word to Hamilton, and I don't remember them listening to it all the time or anything else. But they know every word,
and they will correct their history teachers on things because they've learned them from Hamilton. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. My daughter is all in on hip hop, which is great. The music is great, but yeah, sometimes the language is not my favorite. Just thought of that.
There's that. Yeah.
We have a new podcast on Twit. It's called Valley of Genius. And it's not even, the first episode isn't even out yet, but you have to subscribe now so that you can get it. Valley of Genius, it's author Adam Fisher. He's sharing audio interviews from his book with Leo. So Leo and Adam chat a little bit about it, and then you get to hear about, hackers, founders, and freaks who made Silicon Valley boom. So lots of great names on that. So
that
check
sounds
that
great.
Out. Yeah, it's... It's great. I mean, because hearing people's voices, I think, is wonderful. So it's just an audio podcast, which is great since lots for commutes and such. You can subscribe to our Amazon Flash Briefing. Do you listen to a lot? Do you have a Flash Briefing, or is that not part of your day?
It's not part of my day.
Yeah, I do. I shower, make up all the things while I'm listening to Flash Briefing. So you can.
I'm
going to
try it out. That's new for me.
Yeah, you don't have to wear makeup to listen. Subscribe to our newsletter. Subscribe to this show. Go to twit.tv/NSS. Subscribe to MacBreak Weekly because it's great even without me. Next week I'll be here with Rich DeMuro, and you can see Alex next week on MacBreak Weekly. And Where else? What else do you want to talk about that you've done, the amazing things you've done lately?
I am doing a lot of stuff on Patreon. So PixelCorp has a Patreon a page. And if you want to see me experiment with how we do training, and Andy and I are experimenting with a show that we haven't published anywhere, so the only place to see it is if you go to Patreon. And it's like $5 a month, and mostly that's just there to create a little bump so people have to be serious. And anyway, we'll talk about computer graphics, we'll talk about video production, we'll talk about all those things. And right now it's just kind of a place for me to play where, you know, I've kind of... created kind of a safe place for me to experiment. So I'm doing something there almost every week, and it's usually me streaming from our DC facility and drawing over top of things and talking about, again, how production works. And so if you're interested in that.
Where do they go?
They go to patreon.com/pixelcore.
Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week on the New Screensavers.